Hello, it's time to read the Des Moines Register for today, Tuesday, March 26, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Pat Steele, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Deanna Snyder. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes to the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Today is going to be a blustery day, windy, colder today with a little bit of snow. Winds out of the west-northwest, 20 to 30 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy skies, still pretty good wind, 8 to 16 miles an hour to the west-northwest. Tomorrow will be mostly sunny, a high of 47, and then Thursday we get back up in the 60s under partly sunny skies and warmer conditions. Our normal high for this time of the year is 54, so we're going to be about 16 degrees below that. Record high was set back in 1907 at 88 degrees, and record low 3 degrees in 1955. Sun rose today, 7:07, and it'll set tonight at 7:34 p.m. From the front page or main section of Des Moines Register, headlines are these: state funding delays leave school in a budget bind. There's a bill that might jeopardize the crisis response program, and court has ruled that Trump can post a $175 million bond. In the Metro and Iowa section, use of rap video in a murder trial is upheld. A five-year sentence is in store for a scammer, and information about emergency kits as Iowa plans for disasters. So let's look at our weather and headlines. Now here is Deanna with her first story.
Thank you, Pat. All right, a bill might jeopardize crisis response program. Some providers fear impact on teaming police and health experts. This is from F. Amanda Tugate of the Des Moines Register. On a Wednesday morning in late February, Kenneth Bensley and T.J. Wood rushed to a subdivision in Waukee as the West Des Moines Police Department's co-responder team, responding Dallas County officers, hoped the pair could help a man facing eviction to find mental health services. On the drive to the home in Waukee, Bensley, a longtime suburban police officer, and Wood, a crisis interventionist, sifted through the details. County deputies said they found the man barricaded inside a home that he was supposed to have already vacated. They said they believed they heard gunshots coming from inside the home and set up a perimeter and eventually got the man out and off the property. Bensley said officers recognized the man was in crisis and needed help, not jail, and thought to call on them for additional help. Wood said, "The client defines the crisis. We just kind of meet them where they are at. Sometimes it's just us talking through the situation with them or just listening. Some people just need an ear. Other times people need guidance to get to a crisis center or a hospital or get themselves into rehab." Bensley and Wood make up a handful of Heart of Iowa Community Services co-responder teams, a program that in recent years has diverted hundreds of people in crisis from jail and refer them instead to the proper resources. That same program, which Heart of Iowa plans to expand to rural cities such as Pella and Knoxville, now faces uncertainty as lawmakers consider Governor Kim Reynolds' proposal to overhaul the state's mental health and disability services. Both House and Senate versions of the legislation have cleared committee votes and are awaiting debate. Darcy Ault, Heart of Iowa's CEO, is among several mental health advocates who have voiced concerns over the governor's proposal, which seeks to revamp mental health and substance use treatment services in Iowa by establishing a behavioral health service system. State officials have said the new system is meant to create equitable access for Iowans and would consist of 7 unified districts. The new districts would combine the state's 32 local regions, which consist of 13 mental health and disability service regions, and 19 integrated provider networks that oversee substance use and problem gambling services. who said this? Governor Reynolds said in a prepared statement last month, 25% of adults with serious mental health challenges also suffer from substance use disorder. She said, but right now the system is fractured, preventing Iowans from getting the support they need. By aligning these 32 separate regions into a unified 7, we can improve coordination of services and deliver better treatment for Iowans. The new bill directs the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services to hire an Administrative Services Organization, or ASO, to oversee each of the 7 districts and its service array. HHS would be tasked with maintaining a central data repository to track the new system and its impacts, and to use that data to track behavioral health needs, develop policies, and otherwise perform acts as necessary to enhance the state's overall behavioral health. State leaders said they plan to determine the details of the system's day-to-day functionality in the coming months. The system is expected to be fully operational by July 1st of 2025. While Ault said she favored parts of the proposal, she is also worried about what it could mean for her agency, which is one of the 13 MHDS regions and supports residents in Audubon, Dallas, and Guthrie counties. She said she worries about whether programs such as the co-responder team would fit the system's new requirements or how the system would impact funding. She said she wants to know how the new system would impact organizations like hers that have already done the work to reshape and grow their services. That's where we panic a little bit, she said, with the state trying to switch up what we're doing because we're doing it, Ault said. We have data that shows that we're diverting people from hospital beds. We're getting people triaged in the community. We are stabilizing them in the community. Apart from West Des Moines, suburban Waukee, Clive, and Urbandale police departments also have co-responder teams. The teams pair police officers and mental health professionals dedicated to answering calls involving people in crisis and offer their immediate direct services. The model is slightly different from mobile crisis services, which are usually led by mental health professionals. Patrol officers are likely dispatched first before mental health professionals are brought into the scene. Heart of Iowa and Inside Out Wellness and Advocacy, a partnered mental health service and provider, established the first team in 2022 in Waukee and later in the neighboring cities. Chris Kickbush, who helps lead Waukee's co-responder team, has a crisis intervention officer and said he values in the model focused on understanding and prioritizing people's health and needs. Kickbush, who completed required training to join the new team, explained that patrol officers answering calls involving people in crisis may be unaware of how to help or what resources to relay. Before the correspondent team, Kickbush reflected on his role as a patrol officer and was unsure of what services to dole out for people in need. But once I got this role, it just kind of flipped the script, he said. Since last May, West Des Moines' first co-responder team was fielded hundreds of calls, spending approximately 21,357 minutes, or about 356 hours, working closely with people and linking them to services, according to police data. Wood said a majority of the calls, about 75%, involved people across racial and economic lines struggling with alcoholism. Police data also showed the team has spent exactly 11,111 minutes, or about 185 hours, following up with individuals to offer more assistance. Bensley and Wood said their follow-ups run the gamut. Some calls are met with what may seem like an endless phone trill, while others spur into weekly check-ins or regular conversations. I've worked in human services going on 6 years now, said Wood. The one thing that's a constant uphill battle is just people feeling like the problems they have aren't something worth looking at, or they've grown up with families like mine that paid no attention to mental health or saw it as a sign of weakness. Bensley said other individuals have asked him or Wood to reach out more frequently as a way to help hold them accountable or remind them that they're not alone. Bensley said he and Wood do care. which is why they give people who didn't answer their calls the first few times a few more chances. Wood added that the team's work not only involves them, but at times extends to supporting their families and friends as well. Bensley and Wood said they consider the co-responder model so far successful and view it as vital in combating the stigma around mental health on a community level. Alt said the teams have bridged the gap between law enforcement officers, mental health advocates, and people in need of help. I would say the positive impact that these programs have had in the communities where they are currently located has far surpassed anything we could have imagined, said Alt. I'm so very thankful for the agencies that stepped up to provide this program. It has certainly been a catalyst. Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. Elsewhere from the front page, Des Moines Register, state funding delays leave schools in a budget bind. Districts are struggling to set priorities and tax levels. Stephen Gruber Miller and Samantha Hernandez co-authored this article for the Register. Iowa lawmakers' long delay in setting state funding levels for K through 12 public schools this year has left districts hanging on planning their budgets and hampered negotiations over new union contracts. Districts have been forced to make their best guesses about how much state money they'll receive as they set property tax levels and plan out staffing hiring. Several districts, including Des Moines, West Des Moines, and Johnston, still have not finalized new union contracts. School funding levels, normally completed early in the year, have been held up this year by negotiations over Governor Kim Reynolds' proposals to change the state's area education agencies and raise starting teacher salaries to $50,000 per year. On Thursday, House Republicans passed a bill that would restructure AEA funding, raise teacher pay, and give schools a 2.5% increase in state funding, known as SSA, for the upcoming year. But Senate Republicans went home for the week without debating the bill, and it's not clear whether there's an agreement between the two chambers. House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican from New Hartford, told reporters on Thursday, "We want to give some certainty on SSA. We want to give certainty when it comes to teacher pay. We know school districts are waiting on us to do that. We felt that by combining these three, it gave us the best assurances to get to that governor's desk as quickly as possible." By law, Iowa legislators are supposed to set school funding for the coming school year within 30 days of the governor submitting her budget to the Iowa legislature. This year, that deadline passed February 9th without action from lawmakers. Democrats, including House Minority Leader Jennifer Confris, the Democrat from Windsor Heights, have said the process has left schools flying blind on their budget process. She added, "Republicans have been very behind on getting numbers to schools, so that's the budget part that should be solved first, and it hasn't been." Representative Carter Nordman, a Republican from Panora, the chair of the Education Appropriations Subcommittee, acknowledged that the superintendents he's spoken with are concerned about the delay in setting state funding levels, but understand it has been caused in part by the fight to secure a teacher pay increase. He said, "I've heard from a lot of my superintendents that this would be a lot easier if they knew some numbers going into this budgeting time. But fortunately, there's a delay for good reason, and that we're determining how much more new money is going to go into the educational system." In some cases, the lack of clarity on school funding has led school district officials to create budgets based on their best guesses. All the metro area school districts the Des Moines Register contacted are in the process of approving property tax rates and setting final budgets. Districts have seen their decisions fettered as state funding remains in question, said Jean Christensen, Southeast Polk Community School District spokesperson, affecting issues such as hiring, establishing property tax rate for the new year, and can also inhibit new program initiatives in and outside of the classroom. She said assumptions had to be made to meet deadlines that could create challenges if SSA passes for a higher increase than what was assumed. Tax rates have been at the forefront of school aid discussions because of recent deadlines. Shashank Arora, Des Moines School District's chief financial officer, said, "The challenge here is that once the property rate is sent to the Iowa Department of Management, we cannot increase it, but we can reduce it. That deadline was March 15th. That's why Des Moines is using 4% SSA when calculating its tax rate, he said. Officials do not expect state funding to go above 3%. For internal budget calculations, Des Moines Public School officials are using a 2% SSA estimate, Aurora said. The estimate is based on a 10-year average. The amount of state funding will determine whether Des Moines Public Schools will need to cut $14 million ahead of the 2024-2025 school year budget, he said. If the Senate passes a 2.5% increase, the amount Des Moines will need to cut from its budget would be reduced by $1.25 million. Paul Bulbeck, West Des Moines Community School District's chief financial officer, said inflation rates have exceeded school funding increases over the past several years, which he said has created increased pressure to balance the budget. The budget delay is also affecting teachers' union negotiations, officials say. Typically, we would have finalized our discussions way earlier, late in February, or at the latest, early March, because we send the contracts out by mid-March, Aurora said, and at this time, we still have not sent out our contracts. West Des Moines and Johnston have also reported similar delays in negotiations. Lynn Meadows, Johnston school spokesperson, said, delayed negotiations affect officials' ability to issue contracts to teaching staff and hire ahead of the 2024-25 school year. It certainly would be good to have the information relating to teachers' pay in advance of negotiations with the unions over the next few weeks, Meadows said. In some cases, the problems caused by the lack of state funding figure has reached beyond negotiating teacher pay. Sarah Enfield, Waukee Community School District's chief financial officer, said, because of the unknowns in our budget process, we are unable to offer salary increases and contracts to our 2,200-plus employees, finalize staffing levels for our schools and programs, and finish planning for the next fiscal year, which begins on July 1st. Teachers' union representatives agree the continued lack of details could create a longer-term hiring issue. Des Moines Education Association President Josh Brown said of why some negotiations have stalled. The local district doesn't know what's going to pass over at the Capitol, and we don't want to have to do negotiations twice. Brown said, if contracts had gone out on time, district officials likely would have already known who plans to return for the next school year and which positions will need to be filled. Even if contracts were to go out in the next week, officials might not know who is staying until well into April. We are going to be in a situation that people are going to resign much later in the year. It's going to be harder to fill positions, and I'm afraid about the number of vacant teaching positions that might exist in August due to this delay as well. Schools are also waiting to see the final details of the proposed pay increase for teachers and school staff. The bill that passed the House, which set minimum pay for starting teachers at $47,500 for the upcoming school year, and $50,000 for the following year. Teachers with at least 12 years of experience would be paid a minimum of $60,000 in the coming school year and $62,000 the following year. The bill also has money to help districts pay the higher salaries for experienced teachers and to raise pay for non-salaried staff such as paraeducators. But it's not clear if that will pass the Senate in its current form. Bulbeck said, the proposed teacher pay increase has not affected West Des Moines' budget planning yet because there are not enough details. The district is expecting to see a pay increase for some staff. Bulbeck added that the school year the minimum starting salary in West Des Moines certified staff was $48,451. The amount will likely increase when bargaining for the 2024-25 school year is completed. We need to see the details of this bill to understand how a statutory minimum salary will work itself through the entire salary schedule. At Johnston, the majority of salaries for 527 teachers are over the proposed minimum of $50,000, Meadows said. In Waukee, Enfield said the district is not able to adequately plan how much of its $250 million budget to use for new programming, staff, equipment, and curriculum without more clarity from the state. Enfield said, As the chief financial officer of a large organization, I would ask that the legislators quickly finalize funding so we can move forward planning for the needs of our students and staff. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. All right. The court says Trump can post a $175 million bond. This article is from Aisha Bakshi and Jessica Gwynn of USA Today. Former President Donald Trump got a legal lifeline Monday, an important day for his political and financial future. An appeals court ruled that Trump and his co-defendants need post only a $175 million bond as they appeal their civil real estate fraud trial loss, and gave them 10 more days to do so. Trump had been on the hook to post a $454 million bond by Monday, and he has a big financial payout on the horizon. Trump's Truth Social platform is set to begin trading on the NASDAQ, potentially boosting his net worth by billions. But Trump didn't win all his fights Monday. His lawyers failed to convince a different judge to dismiss a criminal trial on hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. Jury selection in that case will begin April 15th, New York Judge Juan Merchan said. In the hush money case, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee faces 34 felony counts of falsifying New York business records to conceal the real purpose of reimbursements to his former lawyer, Michael Cohen. The New York criminal trial was supposed to begin Monday, but state prosecutors consented to a delay earlier this month after federal prosecutors sent Trump more than 100,000 pages of documents that may be relevant to the case. The Trump team argued the entire case should be thrown out because the prosecution, quote, actively sought to prevent President Trump from obtaining critical materials, unquote. But at the hearing on Monday, Merchan determined prosecutors went above and beyond what they were required to do. He said the federal prosecutor's office isn't under the direction or control of Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office. Trump's team had originally said it would need at least a 90-day trial delay to review the new documents if Merchan didn't throw out the whole case. When that was rejected Monday, Trump lawyer Todd Blanche asked for permission to file a motion to delay the trial based on pretrial publicity. Merchan said Blanche could file the motion but emphasized the trial is scheduled for April 15th. Speaking at a brief news conference at his building on Wall Street after the hearing, Trump said he would continue to seek a delay of the hush money trial past Election Day. He also said he wants a full dismissal. I shouldn't have a trial, he said. Trump faces three other criminal cases with no firm trial dates. He has pleaded not guilty in all his criminal cases. For the civil judgments, Trump had been scrambling to come up with a lot of cash. Along with the $454 million required to appeal the real estate fraud case, Trump faced $83.3 million defamation trial loss to advice columnist E. Jean Carroll. The former president has filed appeals in both cases. In Carroll's case, Trump posted a bond of nearly $92 million shortly before she could have started collecting. But his legal team said in the filing that 30 insurance companies had refused to take real estate as collateral, and that obtaining the $454 million real estate appeal bond was a practical impossibility. New York Attorney General Letitia James was hours away from being allowed to go after Trump's assets. It's still the case that if Trump can't come up with a $175 million bond or deposit within 10 days, James can start the collection process, including liquidating bank accounts and potentially taking real estate. Trump posted on social media Monday, "We will abide by the decision of the appellate division and post either a bond, equivalent securities, or cash." In a statement, James said the full judgment in the case still stands and Donald Trump is still facing accountability for his staggering fraud, he said. Trump lawyer Alina Haba said in her own statement that the appeals court order is the first important step in fighting back against Letitia James and her targeted witch hunt. On Tuesday, Trump will likely be a lot richer, at least on paper. Digital World Acquisition announced Monday that the struggling Truth Social site would begin trading under the ticker DJT. The announcement followed a merger between the platform's parent company, Trump Media and Technology Group, and Digital World, a shell company that was already listed on the NASDAQ. Shares of Digital World Acquisition rose about 25% in Monday trading, reversing losses Friday after investors voted to approve the deal. Trump owns 75 million shares, a stake valued at over $3 billion. Jay Ritter, University of Florida professor, said this is a stock where the market price is divorced from fundamental value. A minor player in the social media universe, where Facebook and TikTok command billions of users, Truth Social has racked up millions of dollars in losses since launching in 2021. It had about 494,000 U.S. mobile app users in February and another 648,000 unique visitors in the U.S. to its website, according to the research firm SimilarWeb. Both stats are down on a year-over-year basis by 51% for mobile apps and 20% for web visitors, the firm said. Truth Social does not disclose its user figures. A prior agreement bars Trump from selling any of his shares or borrowing cash against them for 6 months. However, the media company's board is stacked with allies. Trump did have one undiluted triumph to crow about. Over the weekend, he won two awards at his golf club in Palm Beach, Florida. Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Dan. And that concludes the front page stories on the Register. So we'll shift now to Metro and Iowa for more local news. Use of rap video in murder trial is upheld. Defendant sang along to lyrics containing threats. William Morse of the Register wrote this article. A judge overseeing a Sioux City murder trial did not err in letting jurors hear the defendant singing a rap song containing threats to the victim days before he was killed, the Iowa Supreme Court says. Martez Harrison, known by the nickname Tezo, was shot and killed outside a bar in April 2021. Video of the dispute shows Harrison was embroiled in a fistfight with Lawrence Kennedy III and was on his back when Kennedy punched him when Dwight Evans approached and shot him twice in the stomach. Kennedy and Harrison were friends, according to trial testimony, but Kennedy was there that night looking to beat up Harrison for allegedly striking another man's girlfriend. Kennedy also was friends with Evans, and the two had come to the bar together. Both men were tried separately for murder, and prosecutors argued Kennedy and Evans had planned the assault together. Evans was convicted of murder and Kennedy of lesser charges of voluntary manslaughter, willful injury, and assault. On appeal, Kennedy argued the court permitted inadmissible evidence to be shown to the jury. In particular, he objected to a video from Evans' phone taken 4 days before the shooting of the two of them singing a rap song that included threatening statements about Tezo. In a unanimous decision Friday, the Supreme Court sided with the district judge, reversing an earlier decision by the Iowa Court of Appeals. An attorney for Kennedy did not respond to a message seeking comment. Evidence of criminal defendants performing or listening to violent rap lyrics is controversial because of fears it might unduly bias jurors. Other courts have held that only when the defendant himself is performing the music and only when the lyrics are tied to the specific circumstances of the alleged crime is such evidence admissible. Kennedy's attorneys argued at the trial that the rap video had nothing to do with the crime. Not only was it recorded before Kennedy learned about the alleged assault that made him want to fight Harrison, but he and Evans didn't even write the lyrics. The two were singing along to a pre-existing video by a Chicago rap group, one with hundreds of thousands of views online that referenced someone named Tezo. The American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa, in a brief supporting Kennedy, urged the court to rule singing along to someone else's music is inadmissible evidence in criminal prosecutions. ACLU legal director Rita Bettis-Austin wrote, Just as singing along to Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison Blues is not evidence that the singer shot a man in Reno, rapping along to someone else's diss track is not evidence that the rapper has criminal intent. Prosecutors argued that, even though Kennedy and Evans had not written the lyrics in question, the fact that they specifically chose a song making threats to someone sharing Harrison's nickname just days before killing him was fair game for a jury to consider. Courts have repeatedly warned that violent rap lyrics cannot be used in a way to suggest a defendant is generally prone or to glorify violence. That's not an issue in this case, Justin Edward Mansfield wrote for the court, because the jury already had video showing Kennedy was beating Harrison when he was killed. Mansfield wrote, "The tendency to infer that someone committed a particular act of violence because that person rapped about acts of violence is less of a concern when the acts of violence and who committed them are undisputed. At the same time, the joint conduct and statements on the video were helpful to rebut the notion that Evans acted alone in shooting Tezo without Kennedy's knowledge or approval." More to the point, Mansfield said, if prosecutors offered the video to show Kennedy was planning the killing days in advance, it didn't work. The jury acquitted him of murder, convicting him instead on the lesser manslaughter charge. That verdict suggests that the jury put aside any inference of advanced planning from the cell phone video, he wrote. Rather, the jury must have determined that Kennedy and Evans acted in concert outside the bar, but that the situation was provoked by Harrison and there was no advance plan to kill or harm him. Austin of the American Civil Liberties Union said in a prepared statement that the decision is narrow and leaves courts the discretion to restrict the evidence of rap music in other cases. Austin said, "This opinion does not limit the ability of courts to exclude such evidence after weighing the facts in each case if it determines that the potential for such evidence to be harmful to a criminal defendant's right to a fair trial with the jury outweighs its probative value," Austin said. We believe that should be the result in most cases. The decision reinstates Kennedy's conviction after the Iowa Court of Appeals reversal. He was sentenced to consecutive terms totaling 16 years in prison. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. All right, here's your guide to emergency kits. Plans to have for Iowa disasters. It's Severe Weather Awareness Week. Is your family prepared? This is from Paris Baratza of the Des Moines Register. Living in Iowa means dealing with severe weather such as tornadoes, floods, and extreme temperatures. You knew that already? Well, that's vital information in emergency preparedness, said Ryan Lowry Lee, who is Community Preparedness Officer with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which is FEMA. When people are more informed about what kinds of disasters and hazards can impact them, the more likely they are to prepare for them. Lowry Lee said of one finding in a recent FEMA National Household Survey on preparedness, "Awareness is the first step. But what else can you do?" Severe Weather Awareness Week is March 25th to 29th, and the Des Moines Register spoke with Lowry Lee and Allie Bright of the Iowa Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management on how to plan for a natural disaster and what items you should have in your emergency kit. So here are five things you should know to be prepared for an emergency. Number one, have a plan and build a network of support before an emergency. Have conversations with family, friends, neighbors, church members, and so on about what to do in an emergency, Lowry Lee said. These people also become a network of support that can be especially helpful in these situations and can be especially important for older adults and people with physical, cognitive, and behavioral disabilities, he said. Identify the specific needs of older adults and people with disabilities in your life. Do they utilize medical equipment that requires power? And what can be done in the event of a power outage? Do they require medication that they need a supply of in an emergency? Those are the conversations people can also have with their doctors and insurance to see, for example, if it's possible to have an extra several day supply of their medications, Bright said. Some other topics to discuss as you make plans with loved ones include, How can we stay in contact if we're separated from each other? Well, one suggestion is to designate someone to contact outside of where you live, Bright said. That way, if you're separated from your loved ones in an emergency and have difficulties contacting each other in your affected area, your out-of-town contact can pass along messages. Do we have a meeting place was another topic to discuss. And do we have the contact information of our loved ones? All right. Number two, build your emergency supply kit. And don't forget your pets. Build a kit with 3 to 5 days' worth of supplies. That includes a suggested 1 gallon of water per person per day. So a household of five would need 25 gallons of water for 5 days. Oh, and don't forget pets need about a half a gallon to a gallon of water, too, Bright added. Lowry Lee said, items that you'll need include non-perishable foods and a can opener for all the canned food you may have, flashlights, batteries, a pair of sneakers, socks, and a jacket, and pet food. Include your entire household in the emergency kit making. Households with young children might want to include items that will help keep their minds off whatever emergency they're facing, he said. So what supplies am I forgetting? Well, documentation, for one. Bright said insurance contact information for your doctor and medical records are among the important documents that you'll want to have. Keep digital copies, perhaps stored on a flash drive, said Bright, or have documents stored in a fireproof safe, suggested Lowry Lee. Stay informed. Alert Iowa and local media can help during a disaster. Bright explained, Alert Iowa is a statewide emergency communication system that 92 counties use. Visit homelandsecurity.iowa.gov/alert-iowa to see if your county utilizes the system and sign up for alerts, which include weather alerts to local alerts that may include information on evacuation shelters, if you're under a boil order, and more. Bright said, tuning into local media is another way to stay informed about what's going on in your community. FEMA also has an app that you can put in up to 5 zip codes to get emergency alerts for those areas. Alerts on your phone can be especially helpful in case of an emergency in the middle of the night to wake you and get you informed. Are you feeling overwhelmed? Well, here are some tips. Time, resources, and money are barriers for some in being prepared for an emergency, said Lowry Lee. His suggestion is to start with what costs nothing, being informed and signing up for emergency alerts for where you live. When it comes to building your kit, start with water, Bright suggested. Other tips for building your emergency kit and getting prepared for an emergency from Bright and Lowry Lee include these things. Hold on to your old shoes and put them in your emergency kit. Visit ready.iowa.gov to find checklists for your emergency kits, and visit ready.gov to find specific information on how to prepare for different severe weather events, tips for older adults, an emergency supply and list, and more. Reach out to your local emergency management before an emergency. Learn from them what resources at the local level can be provided to help you be prepared. Polk County Emergency Management can be reached at 515-286-2107. Take advantage of free classes on disaster preparedness and trainings. And remember, you don't need to build your emergency kit all at once. It takes time, and that's okay. Pat, back to you.
Good advice. Also from the Metro and Iowa section, a 5-year sentence in store for scammer. Lee Rude, the Register's Reader's Watchdog, wrote this story. A Des Moines man who has scammed women on dating apps for most of his adult life will receive a 5-year sentence for violating his probation tied to convictions in 2 Iowa counties. John F. Clark, age 55, signed documents admitting that he violated probation by leaving the state, getting fired from his job without telling his probation officer, and missing appointments with the officer. The 5-year prison sentence will be for violations in Polk and Linn counties. He faces a total of 15 years total behind bars for the same alleged probation violations in Blackhawk County in a case that has not yet been resolved. Clark is also scheduled for trial April 29th on charges of felony theft after allegedly stealing 10 Lotto scratch tickets from a Hy-Vee Fast and Fresh where he worked, court records say, and he's being investigated by the FBI on a referral from the United States Attorney's Office, court records show. He was featured in a Watchdog column on Valentine's Day after he'd been outed by many of his victims in Facebook chats and amassed a stack of complaints to the Iowa Attorney General and local law enforcement agencies in at least 6 Iowa counties and 5 states. He had never served much time behind bars despite numerous convictions and was arrested in December at a Marshalltown bar after some of his victims leaned hard on law enforcement to take action. Clark is being held in the Polk County Jail, but could not be reached for comment. Clark's modus operandi was well documented in reams of court cases. Gain the trust of single women, pose as an employee of a cell phone company, gain access to their phone, service plans and credit, and use their resources to purchase electronics, including cell phones and Apple Watches that were later sold or pawned. His long rap sheet includes convictions in Johnston, Linn, Marshall, Polk, and Story counties in Iowa, and numerous counts of theft, identity theft, forgery, and parole violations. Though he's labeled a habitual offender under Iowa law, judges and prosecutors let him take plea deals, allowing for probation or short stints in jail, only to have him to commit more crimes, court records show. Two women who lived hundreds of miles apart near Columbia, Missouri, and Madison, Wisconsin, both told police prior to his arrest that Clark also worked his dating app scam on them. He admitted traveling last fall outside Iowa, but denied he committed any new crimes in the stipulation he signed in Polk County. Deanna?
He's busy. All right, FAA grants helping Iowa community colleges aviation maintenance program really take off. This is from Brooklyn Drazy of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. Adam Townsend has been a mechanic his whole life and plans to turn into a career upon completion of his training at Indian Hills Community College. He found his passion for aviation in high school, and though he thought about becoming a pilot, aviation maintenance allows him to combine his interests at a college close to home with a good program. Now in his second year of the program, Townsend already is interning at a company in Des Moines and plans to continue there full-time after graduation. He said the recognition Indian Hills Community College is receiving through a federal grant solidifies his opinion of how good and important the school's training is. He said, "It makes me proud, honestly. It makes me feel that much more confident in my schooling and the knowledge that I have absorbed through my professors and throughout the school." He said, "It makes me feel like I'm more prepared." The Federal Aviation Administration has awarded a combined total of almost $1.3 million to 3 Iowa community colleges to help update and support their aviation training programs. Indian Hills Community College and Iowa Western Community College are receiving $302,816 and $500,000 for their aviation maintenance and mechanics programs, respectively. And Iowa Lakes Community College has been awarded $493,657. Each school will use funds from the grants to obtain new equipment and technology for its program, from virtual reality systems to drones. Kimberly Dredden, Indian Hills Community College North Campus's program director, said there is a lot of theory involved in the aviation maintenance curriculum that can be hard to understand unless the students can actually see the equipment. Having new training aids and virtual reality systems will help students better understand what they're working with. Dredden said, "Our goal is to use some of these funds to obtain these trainings so students can see how these systems work and what the general flow is, minus just using a diagram like giving them a very active engagement with it." Equipment like VR technology also can be taken into classrooms to show high school students what they would be doing if they pursue a career in aviation mechanics, and to provide access to people who cannot commute to the college for in-person training. Kyle Norris, an executive dean at Iowa Lake Community College, said the college is planning to expand its aviation programming into emerging technologies like drones and rotary wing piloting, and is opening new aviation cohorts in Spencer and Estherville. One of its goals is to fill the aviation career pipeline and reach more students through the region. Drones, simulators, and other technology will help the college engage with more high school students and show them that there isn't just one path for aviation students, Norris said. He went on, "This will help us open those doors to high school students that might be thinking of a career in agriculture, and they really have a keen interest in the aviation side, and understanding that it just doesn't mean flying planes for a commercial industry." Promotion of the programs is another area where the colleges will be putting dollars, including expanding partnerships with schools and employers in order to attract students. Diana Garcia, Dean of Industrial Technology and Transportation at Iowa Western Community College, said the college previously used a different FAA grant for the same purpose with positive results. Indian Hills Community College and Iowa Western Community College also will allocate some of the grant to stipends and scholarships for students in order to relieve some of their financial burdens while they try to earn their certifications. Dredden said costs of new tools and even certification examinations can be a barrier for some students, especially if they're handling housing and food costs alongside them, and the college wants to offer support where it can. Like Townsend, Dredden has personal ties to her passion. Growing up with her father and grandfather, both involved in aviation mechanics, she knows firsthand the career's benefits, but she also knows the barriers for people trying to get their start in the industry. Being able to help students receive the tools and access they need to thrive is important, especially in an industry where the college can't give them enough people, she said. Beth Ellman, Marketing Executive Director for Iowa Lakes Community College, said even better than receiving the funds is seeing the passion in students as they experience the college's programming. She said, "It's exciting that we're able to have those funds to help catapult the lives of future students. And I think that that's what these grants really mean," Ellman said. "They're investing in our program, but really, they're investing in our future and the future of our students." Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Dan, and we'll finish up the Metro Iowa section here with a couple shorter stories. A man is charged with attempted murder for allegedly setting a house on fire. Jose Mendiola, the Register, wrote this article. A Des Moines man was arrested and charged with attempted murder and arson after allegedly pouring gasoline on his girlfriend and setting his house on fire on Sunday, the Des Moines Police Department said in a news release yesterday. The police department and the Des Moines Fire Department were dispatched to the 3100 block of Amherst Street to investigate a residential fire around 2:55 p.m., according to police spokesperson Paul Parizek. Witnesses told first responders that the suspect who started the fire was still in the house, Parizek said. Authorities found Pa Lo Ball, age 36, inside the home, and he was detained without incident. Police noted that Ball's clothing smelled like gasoline and his hair and eyebrows were singed from igniting the fire, according to court documents. Ball allegedly told investigators he was upset with his 39-year-old girlfriend because she did not want to eat with him, the court documents say. He allegedly admitted to retrieving a can of gasoline and spreading it throughout the hallway before starting the fire with a black light, the court documents say. He also allegedly poured gasoline on his girlfriend, who tried to extinguish the fire before leaving the house, Parizek said. He later told investigators he was not trying to harm his girlfriend, the court documents say. Parizek said, prior to igniting the gasoline, Ball reportedly told his girlfriend that because there were no children in the home, he was going to set them both on fire. Nobody was seriously injured, and the house sustained minor damage. Ball has been charged with attempted murder, arson, and domestic abuse with intent to inflict serious injuries, Prezik said. He is currently being held at the Polk County Jail, and police are still investigating the case. And another story, Windsor Heights video production owner arrested on child porn charges. This is a story written by Kyle Werner of the Register. The owner of a video production company in Windsor Heights has been arrested on charges related to child pornography. Frederick Amundson, age 57, the owner of Gatehouse Pictures, a video production company in Windsor Heights on University Avenue, was charged Thursday with 22 counts of possession of child pornography. According to court documents, a search warrant was issued in April 2022. The FBI found 22 images on a computer, according to court documents. In February, another Central Iowan was charged with child pornography possession. This is the second case this year of child pornography possession in the Metro. Amundson is under a no-contact order for anyone under the age of 18, as issued by the court. There is a cash-only $100,000 bond set for him. A preliminary hearing is set for April 1st. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. All right, the CEO at Boeing is leaving as the company battles safety problems. This is from David Shepherdson and Allison Lampert. Boeing CEO David Calhoun will step down by year-end in a broad management shakeup brought on by the plane maker's sprawling safety crisis, exacerbated by a January mid-air panel blowout on a 737 MAX plane. Stan Deal, Boeing Commercial Airplanes president and CEO, will retire, and Stephanie Pope will take over that business, the company said Thursday. Stephen Mullenkopf, former CEO of tech company Qualcomm, has been appointed the new chair of the board and is leading the search for the next CEO. The leadership changes cap weeks of turmoil at Boeing after the mid-air incident involving an Alaska airline operated by MAX 9 jet carrying 171 passengers turned into a full-blown safety and reputational crisis for the iconic company. Boeing shares have lost roughly one quarter of their value since the incident. The January incident was only the most recent in a series of safety crises that have shaken the industry's confidence in Boeing and hampered its ability to increase production. Calhoun himself was brought in as CEO following a pair of crashes in 2018 and 2019 that killed nearly 350 people. Some investors expressed concern that this shakeup would not be enough to address these issues. Cameron Dawson, chief investment officer at New Edge Wealth, said, "We've long thought that the issues at Boeing have been seated in cultural challenges." Analysts and investors called the shakeup positive for Boeing, but stressed that much depends on Calhoun's successor and changing the company's culture from the top. Some suggested Spirit AeroSystems CEO Patrick Shanahan, a former Boeing executive and U.S. government official, as a possible successor to Calhoun. Vertical Research Partners aerospace analyst Robert Stallard said in a note to his clients, "We think it will require someone with pedigree and patience, as fixing Boeing is probably a multi-year, non-linear journey." Following the January incident, the FAA curbed Boeing production to a rate of 38 jets per month. But CFO Brian West said last week it had not even reached that figure. Since Calhoun, age 66, took the reins, the company has endured ongoing production delays. Still, in October, Calhoun was upbeat over how fast Boeing could raise output of its MAX jets, saying Boeing would get back to 38 jets a month and was anxious to build from there as fast as we can. But weeks after the mid-air cabin panel blowout in January, Calhoun said it's time to go slow, or to go slow to go fast. The company's crisis has frustrated airlines, already struggling with delivery delays from both Boeing and its main rival, Airbus, and the plane maker has been burning more cash than expected in this quarter than expected. "For years, we prioritized the movement of the airplane through the factory over getting it done right. And that's got to change," said West last week. Airbus clinched orders for 65 jets from two of Boeing's key Asian customers recently, and what some saw as a sign of executives' concerns about Boeing. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. Elsewhere, justice is set to hear abortion pill case. Tuesday's arguments could open path for total ban of procedure. This is a story for Maureen Gropey of USA Today. 2 years after the Supreme Court erased the constitutional right to an abortion, creating a patchwork of access across the country, the justices could pave the way to a national ban. In a case they are considering Tuesday about access to the abortion drug mifepristone, the court might give legitimacy to a 19th century obscenity law that some abortion opponents promote as the de facto federal abortion ban that just needs enforcing the Comstock Act. Named for the anti-vice crusader and U.S. Postal Inspector Anthony Comstock, the long-dormant law prohibits mailing lewd or lascivious material as well as anything that could be used to cause an abortion. Even if the court decides the case without addressing the 1873 law, which it could easily do, the justices could restrict access to mifepristone in a way that would make it more difficult for millions of women to end a pregnancy in states where abortion is legal. The result would be an end run around the court's stated purpose when it overturned Roe v. Wade of leaving the question of abortion to Congress and state legislatures, according to abortion rights advocates. Keeping in place a lower court's decision restricting access to mifepristone, more than 640 state lawmakers wrote in a brief to the court would wrest the power to decide abortion access issues back out of the hands of state legislators. Abortion opponents say it's the Food and Drug Administration that is doing the end run around the Supreme Court's 2022 decision by enabling women to circumvent state abortion bans by allowing unreasonably easy access to mifepristone. The FDA's actions robbed from the people important decisions in this vital issue, the attorney generals of 22 states told the court. More than 6 in 10 abortions in the U.S. last year were completed with pills, according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights. The Supreme Court is deciding whether the FDA, improperly relaxed requirements on mifepristone, one of the two drugs used in medication abortions for early pregnancies. The New Orleans-based 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said the FDA should not have allowed mifepristone to be dispensed through the mail along with other changes. The Biden administration said the agency's decisions were based on extensive evidence. They said the case marks the first time a court has restricted access to an FDA-approved drug by second-guessing the agency's expert judgment. The anti-abortion groups challenging mifepristone dispute the FDA's conclusion that the changes it allowed are warranted. They also argue that the FDA is violating the Comstock Act. Over the years, courts and Congress narrowed the scope of the 1873 law, and it hasn't been enforced by the federal government since the 1930s. But the federal judge, appointed by former President Donald Trump, who first heard the mifepristone challenge, said the Comstock Act prohibits the mailing of abortion drugs. While the appeals court did not rely on the Comstock Act in ruling the FDA went too far, anti-abortion advocates have raised the issue in their filings to the Supreme Court. They argue the Justice Department was wrong to say last year that the law's prohibition on mailing abortion drugs applies only to those used for illegal abortions. The department issued that decision to make it clear the United States Postal Service could deliver abortion pills even in states that have banned or restricted abortion access because they can be used for other purposes, including to manage miscarriages and for exceptions to abortion bans. The interpretation of the law is strongly rejected by 145 Republican members of the House and Senate. The FDA blatantly violated the prohibition on mailing chemical abortion drugs by permitting mail-order chemical abortions. Those lawmakers wrote in a brief supporting the mifepristone challenge. Former Attorney General Edwin Meese III and Attorney Jay Sekulow, who represented Trump during his first impeachment, is now chief counsel at the American Center for Law and Justice, made similar arguments to the court.